This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
It's hard to imagine them going out to deliberate next Thursday and then holding it until the Tuesday after Memorial Day, Rhonda? Tom's betting on a quick deliberation.
I am too. Rhonda, like I said, you know, New Yorkers, and I'm saying this as someone who has lived in Manhattan. You have places to go, people to see, you're on the move like that.
We will never give up, we will never concede, it doesn't happen.
I object to you getting one.
And now, if you don't mind, I'm going to go into the icebox and sit for a long time. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Trump Trials Sidebar from The Washington Post. I'm Libby Casey, and I'm here in our studio with...
Rhonda Colvin.
James Holman.
Tom Jackman.
Tom Jackman, criminal justice reporter. Thrilled to have you here, Tom. He's been in New York covering the trial. And Tom and team, it all comes down to Michael Cohen and the cross-examination by Donald Trump's lawyers, which is happening as we record right now. Can Trump's team poke enough holes in Cohen's credibility to make the jurors doubt his story? And his story is that Donald Trump knew Cohen had paid off Stormy Daniels to stay quiet, that Trump had told him just take care of it, that Cohen was reimbursed in payments disguised as legal fees, and that Trump knew all about it, approved the scheme, and signed the checks. On today's episode of Sidebar, how it's going for the prosecution and the defense. Also, it's the place to see, and more importantly, be seen in New York City if you are a Republican. No, it's not Katz Delicatessen or Beef Bar in Tribeca or Balthazar in Soho. It is 100 Center Street on the 15th floor. Because that's where all Republicans who want to have a shot at, I don't know, say being vice president or just being in Trump's good graces are going to boost his morale and get attention. We're also going to talk about the man who's tasked with moving things efficiently in court, and that's Supreme Court Justice Juan Merchan. And we'll wrap up with talking about the timeline of just how much longer this case could take. Let's start with what we're seeing today in New York. Michael Cohen, pivotal witness or serial liar, out for revenge. So, Tom, let's talk about how the prosecution's doing, all right? We're going to talk pros and cons.
Sure.
So in the pros category, what are they using Michael Cohen to do, and how is it working?
They're using Michael Cohen to link Donald Trump to the crime. The crime is filing these papers, which covered up the fact that this was a campaign expense. The spending of the money, the paying to Stormy Daniels, is a campaign expense. Instead, it's mislabeled as a legal expense. Trump would say, I didn't have anything to do with that. And Cohen has been brought in to say he had everything to do with that. He told me to take care of this. I did take care of it. I drummed up the money myself. We saw testimony earlier from the bank that handled his account. And then, the money was then wired to Stormy Daniels' lawyer. So that all happened. But how it was documented and how it was written down, did Trump have knowledge? And they've brought in Michael Cohen to say, yes, of course he had knowledge. You know, I didn't do this on my own. And he's the linchpin of the case, Michael Cohen is. He's the one who's going to either be believed that Trump did mastermind this, or if they poke holes in Cohen's credibility to the point that some jurors say, I don't believe him, then the case goes down the tubes.
You know, the Trump Trials newsletter had this great line about Michael Cohen's not seeming like a jerk. And that's a really blunt way to put it. But Rhonda, that's important here.
Yeah, I think that's what everyone might have expected.
That he would seem like a jerk.
Right, because we've seen him. He's been, out there for the last, a little less than a decade. And people have seen the way he acts. People know him, as James had discussed earlier this week on our emergency show, the way he treated journalists. He seems very reactionary. So I think a lot of people expected him to have moments where the defense lawyer prosecutors were able to get under his skin. He reacts, you know, tanks the prosecution's utility of him. But he hasn't done that so far. So that, you know, just observing and also reading the transcripts, you just wonder, does Cohen realize that this is his moment? This actually may be his very last moment to tell all about Trump. He did it when he testified in front of Congress in 2019. He also testified in the civil suit that Letitia James brought. And he was in front of Trump then, too. But this might be the very last time he can tell all. And he may understand the importance and the weight of that.
Yeah. Well, Rhonda, you've covered his congressional testimony, though, and he was not hot-headed and reactionary, bombastic in that. But this is different because there's the defense who can push him, but Republicans could push him. I mean, James, like, what?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. Cohen is the central. He is both a liar and the central witness. I think that parts of his story, even if you're incredibly skeptical of Cohen's credibility, are plausible. So Cohen says, I kept Donald Trump updated really for three reasons. One is Cohen wanted the credit. And if you watch Michael Cohen, you can see that. Two, he wanted to get reimbursed. He wanted the $130,000 back that he put out of pocket. That sort of makes sense. And three, that everything in the Trump organization had to get Trump's sign off, which is also plausible. That matches our reporting over the years, going back to the Trump book from the 2016 campaign. Everything we know about the Trump organization is that on this kind of thing, he was a micromanager. So all of that rings true. Certain parts of the story ring less true. Like Cohen is offering all sorts of dialogue that we really haven't heard before, where it's like, I asked Trump how it was being taken upstairs, which is a reference to Melania Trump. And he,
I want you to slow down with that. How it was being taken upstairs. Like, exactly. Like in other words, how Melania was interpreting this allegation of a porn star saying she had sex with Donald Trump and they had to keep her quiet about
it. And so Cohen, in his telling, says Trump told him, I wouldn't stay on the market for long. I'm such an eligible bachelor. Like, I'd find another woman soon. And I mean, that sort of strains credulity. And so there's other parts of the story where you're kind of like,
you're Cohen, incredulous that Trump said that?
I don't think it's a weird thing to say, but maybe he said it.
Sounds like something he would say.
Such an innocent.
On cross-examination.
Can I just interrupt you about why this is important, though? Because the motivation is so key. Yes, exactly. Like, was he trying to cover up this allegation, whether it was true or not, to protect his wife, who was at the time the mother of a new baby?
Right.
His baby. Or was he trying to do it for a campaign reason? So that's why that sort of, even though it feels sort of icky and salacious, it's like a detail that matters.
And Cohen said it's all campaign. Yeah. Cohen said Trump wanted to know if they could kind of drag this out until after the election, because after the election in 2016, they didn't care. And they didn't think that they were going to win the election, which is what Cohen said, which raises the then question of like, well, why did he care if he didn't think he was going to win? And I mean, you get into all these questions about motives, and ultimately, we don't know what's in the juror's head as they're watching all this.
So, you know, we have access to the transcripts. Now, Tom has been in the court, so he's heard this testimony firsthand. But the rest of us aren't able to do that because there's no audio feed, no video feed, of course. So what we've done, and we did this in two episodes ago, we've had some of our colleagues read some of the back and forth from the transcript. This is not a dramatic recreation. You will not hear the thick Long Island accent of Michael Cohen. This is really just for us to get a sense of what is said and who said it. So the first voice that you will hear is prosecutor Susan Hoffinger. And the second voice you'll hear is the reading of Michael Cohen's words. Let's listen.
And what was his reaction?
He was really angry with me. I thought you had this under control. I thought you took care of this. I expressed to Mr. Trump, we did, 2011. I have no control over what she goes out and does. And he expressed to me, there's a previous denial. Just take care of it. There was a lot going on at the campaign at that time. He was like, just take care of it.
Did he say anything to you at the time about how this might be viewed if it got out?
Yes.
What did he say in substance?
He said to me, this is a disaster, total disaster. Women are going to hate me because this is really a disaster. Women will hate me. Guys may think it's cool, but this is going to be a disaster for the campaign.
All right, that's a reading of the transcripts by our colleagues. The first voice you heard was Susan Hoffinger, prosecutor's words. The second voice was Michael Cohen's words. Tom.
That's a crucial moment, you know, in terms of establishing Trump's intent, the mens rea, as the lawyers like to say, of why he did what he did. And here, the intent is to protect the campaign. It is not to protect his family or to keep Melania from hearing this horrible stuff. This is to, keep the campaign from being damaged. And that's at the heart of the charges, is that this is, you know, falsifying records to keep from having to reveal this campaign expenditure, which was the hush money to Stormy Daniels.
Yeah, also in the transcripts from this week is Cohen laying out how explosive that Access Hollywood moment was, that it was a moment in that campaign where it seemed like all business had to stop. Everybody had to be all hands on deck and figure out their way through this because they thought it was going to be so damaging. So again, that gets to that intent and motivation behind this, that this is an election interference case, as the prosecution has been saying. It is not simply just a private matter that Trump wanted to, you know, hide infidelity from his wife.
And so they brought in Hope Hicks to talk about that as a witness, to talk about the impact of the Access Hollywood tape and how much angst was in the Trump campaign as they tried to deal with that. Mm-hmm. They were dealing with that, and then along comes the Stormy Daniels matter within a week or two.
So pros for the prosecution. Michael Cohen is linking Donald Trump, knowledge of the scheme, knowledge of the payments, paying for the payments, also staying cool on the witness stand, cool, calm, and collected. Let's talk about receipts. What kind of receipts is he bringing, Tom?
Cohen?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's got all of his paperwork that he got paid monthly payments in 2017, a year after this happened, which is a pretty good corroboration that he did get reimbursed ultimately. There's also a piece of paper with Alan Weisselberg's writing on it. Alan Weisselberg was the chief financial officer of the Trump Organization. And Weisselberg writes on a Cohen invoice after Cohen had created this shell corporation. Weisselberg writes down the amounts that he is to be paid, which is $180,000 grossed up to $360,000, so that he won't have to take as big of a tax hit, although you don't have to take any tax hit if it's actually a reimbursement.
But they weren't saying it was a reimbursement.
Correct.
They were disguising it as legal
expense,
fees.
Right. And so it's income.
All right, let's get to James's concerns about Michael Cohen as a reliable witness. Things that are going against the prosecution or that really are going in favor of Donald Trump's team. Right now, as we record this, Michael Cohen is being cross-examined. And this has already been an extensive process. It could go on longer. James, what are the holes that Trump's team is trying to poke in his story or his reliability?
Yeah, so the Cohen's actually doing a better job on Thursday than he did on Tuesday. When the prosecution was questioning him on Monday, he gave very direct answers. On Tuesday, he was more evasive. It was like, was that a lie? And he would say, well, it wasn't accurate. And then it was like, so are you saying it's a lie? And on Thursday,
he just sounds like a lawyer to me.
Well, right.
Too soon for lawyer
just kind
jokes.
Of, yeah, okay. Too soon for lawyer jokes.
Okay.
On Thursday, he's doing a little bit better. But I do think Todd Blanche has done a couple things. One is to really show that Cohen has a personal stake in the outcome of this trial. Cohen's made $3.3 or $3.4 million from his two anti-Trump books. He said he was willing to lie and plead guilty to tax evasion in his taxi medallion business because he wanted to protect his wife. And Todd Blanche said, so you lie when you have a personal stake in something. And then a few minutes later, he comes back and he's asking Michael Cohen about how much he hates Trump. And he says, so you, it seems like you have a personal stake in the outcome of this trial. And Cohen said, yes, of course. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a very damning moment. Can we
pause there? Because I want to hear more about how Cross is going today on Thursday as we record this. But I want to play some of the transcribed red tape that we have. This is from something that happened on Tuesday. A reminder that court has not been sitting on Wednesday, so this is still quite fresh. And again, these are our colleagues reading the words of two people. Trump's lawyer, defense attorney Todd Blanche. That's the first voice you'll hear. The second voice is someone reading the words of Michael Cohen. And they refer to Mea Culpa, which is one of not just one, but two of Michael Cohen's podcasts. So let's listen.
You've also talked about extensively on Mea Culpa your desire to see that President Trump gets convicted in this case, correct?
Sounds like something I would say.
Well, sir, I'm not asking you if it sounds like something you would say. I'm saying, did you? have you regularly commented on your podcast that you want President Trump to be convicted in this case?
Yes, probably.
Do you have any doubt?
No.
So why did you just answer yes, probably?
Because I don't specifically know if I use those words, but yes, I would like to see that.
And so, yes, you want to see President Trump get convicted from this case, correct?
I would like to see accountability. It's not for me. It's for the jury and this court.
I didn't ask you what you wanted to see or not see about accountability. I said, do you want to see President Trump convicted in this case?
That's what we just said. You're asking me if I want to see.
I'm just asking you to say yes or no. Do you want President Trump to get convicted in this case?
Sure.
Those are the transcript readings of Michael Cohen and Trump defense attorney Todd Blanche.
So Devlin Barrett, who writes our Trump Trials newsletter that is really excellent and also writes for the live blog where this stuff is all going up in real time, which you can follow. And it is like being right in the courtroom. He noted today on the live blog that the juxtaposition of how Cohen speaks softly, slowly and politely in the courtroom is particularly jarring when they're playing some of the clips from Mea Culpa. Mm. You know, when they're playing the audio of Cohen being brash. And even on the podcast or vodcast, there's things that they had Cohen saying that I don't think we can say for family newspaper. I have a list in front of me. And the words, it is pretty remarkable what Cohen has called Trump in the last few months. Among things that are maybe a borderline, he called him dictator douchebag. He said he hoped Trump would be jailed like an animal. He called Trump a Cheeto dusted cartoon villain. And he said he won't be satisfied until he sees Donald Trump sitting in a jail cell.
And these are things that the jury's hearing in the tapes being played.
Exactly. This isn't just like me reading a sanitized version of it. It's Cohen saying it viscerally, mm-hmm. and it does get at his motive. But he's also just a congenital liar. It's just a fact. One of my favorite moments from Blanche questioning him today was that right after Trump was indicted last year, Cohen went on TikTok and he had this statement where he said, I want to thank the Manhattan District Attorney's Office for their fearless leader, Alvin Bragg, with whom I've spent countless hours. And Blanche said, have you ever met Alvin Bragg? And the answer was no. And so Cohen admits on the witness stand that he's never met or spent time with Bragg. And he's here on TikTok saying adamantly that he spent countless hours. And it's all about reasonable doubt. Mm. Do you have a reasonable doubt that Cohen is lying about Trump's involvement? And like, I think a juror could be like, wow, this guy lies about everything. Why wouldn't he be lying? I do have a reasonable doubt. So in that sense, I do think Todd Blanche has landed some punches.
Also, in today's cross, I've noticed that they're trying to get Cohen to react to the fact that he was upset he did not receive a White House position. They've really dug into that. They even asked questions about was it hard for him to get a ticket to the inauguration? And he said it was. They have text messages between Cohen and his daughter kind of complaining about, you know, the boss wants to talk to me. I think I might be getting a position. Then it didn't look like he was going to get the position. So they're trying to also add that as a part of his motives for telling all is that he is a man with an axe to grind. You know, they also kind of similarly use the same tactic against Stormy Daniels. They asked her, do you hate Trump? She said yes. She was very candid. And I've been wondering, I know we don't have the answer to these questions yet, but I've been wondering if going after someone's character too much will backfire for the defense, where the jury is listening to Cohen admit that he has lied before. And because he's being so candid, the jury's like, okay, well, he's telling us he's a liar. But there's also some physical evidence. At least there's, you know, tapes and receipts that they can also look at and see that, well, perhaps there is some smoke and there's some fire where there's smoke.
Totally. It's not just Cohen's word. I mean, Tom has covered more trials than anyone I know. I mean, what is that, to Rhonda's point, how does that dynamic usually play out? Obviously, this is different because it's a former president and it's so high profile. But
I've seen juries that have heard exactly the same thing. This witness is a terrible person. This witness has multiple convictions. And then the jury believes them. I've also seen juries believe people that I've found, I know, lied, but the juries believed them. I think that putting in this sort of undertone that Stormy Daniels and Michael Cohen have want Trump to be convicted, I don't think that that hurts them that much, because the jury is to say, yeah, of course they want him convicted. Why is he sitting here in the first place? Why are they complaining? Why are they writing these books about Trump? Of course they want him convicted. So I don't think that's going to be as much of a negative for the prosecution, as Cohen's background, his willingness to lie, if whether that, you know, grabs a juror or two who say, you know, maybe he is making this stuff up. But it would be a lot of stuff to make up, and it would be stuff that is otherwise corroborated by people who aren't as shady.
Tom, you know, this is your first time covering a trial at 100 Center Street,
right,
sort of legendary building and courtroom in New York on the 15th floor.
Right.
Is there grandeur or like largeness to this that you think the jury's feeling? A former president, like so much attention.
They must be. They must be. I mean, they're moved in and out of that courtroom, you know, and out of that building. Nobody ever sees them. And in fact, even in the overflow room, they turn the cameras off when the jury comes. I guess they have to walk past the bench to get to the jury seating. And so after everyone is seated, the judge is there, the prosecutors, the defense, they're all there. And then they turn the cameras off for the jury to come in. And I think the jury absolutely has a sense of this. You know, a couple of people got selected and then said, I don't think I can do this. I'm pretty nervous. My friends know I'm on this jury. And so immediately they lost two alternates when people who were, I think, intimidated by the largeness of this case said, yeah, I can't handle it.
All right, coming up, we're going to talk about the gallery of people who are coming to cheer Trump on and also get seen by the cameras. Stay with us.
On a summer night, Douglas Wag Jr. lay motionless across a strip of railroad tracks before being struck by an oncoming train. I'm investigative journalist Delia D'Ambra, and my investigation into exactly how Doug died took me into the depths of a bizarre mystery.
It was really hard to understand what was fact and what wasn't.
A mystery that has led me from one suspicious death to another. Listen to Counterclock now, wherever you listen to podcasts.
If a friend asks how you're doing, and you say,
I'm okay.
When the truth is,
I don't want my problems to burden anyone.
Or you say,
hang in there.
Because
if I ask for help, they'll just think I'm weak.
Then this is your sign to call, text, or chat. 988 for free, confidential support. Anytime. You don't have to hide how you feel.
This is the Trump Trials Sidebar from The Washington Post. Rhonda, you are a congressional correspondent, and we've considered relocating you to New York City because it seems like every member of the Republican Party is hanging out, not down here in Washington where they're supposed to be getting things done, but in New York. What is going on?
It has been a revolving door. You're right. I have wondered what the margin is. I should do the math of how many House Republicans and some senators that we've seen visit Trump at this time, and some are sitting in the courtroom as well. And we've also seen Speaker Mike Johnson go and also have a press conference there. You know, it's interesting. It's, again, one of those moments in time where we have not seen anything like this. Of course, politicians have had to fight court cases and they've had scandals, but very rarely have you seen such a coalescing around someone who is in legal trouble with the weight of the legislative branch.
Yeah, I mean, Tom and Jim,
typically
Tom's
a scandal.
Like, yeah.
Typically a scandal, people stay away.
That's the perspective.
Best of luck to you, but we'll watch you from down here. And it's amazing to see people show up and sit in the courtroom with him and then go out. Some of them have said, Tommy Tuberville said, I'm going out there to say the things that Trump can't say, as in defy the court order, which some have thought the prosecution might raise as a violation of the court order.
Right.
So, yeah, it is extremely weird that somebody who is, you know, charged with felonies is getting this kind of support in the political realm.
Yeah, and what's also been striking to me, too, is it's not even the physical presence. Many people may not realize that members of Congress have been actually using the tools of the legislative branch to help support Trump. There was actually a hearing yesterday with the House Oversight Subcommittee where they had Robert Costello be a witness. Now, he is a lawyer who was once in Trump's orbit. Michael Cohen has testified that Costello contacted him after the raid on Cohen's home and said, you know, stay cool, we'll protect you. Witness tampering, basically. He was in front of Congress members yesterday talking about Cohen being a liar. You've had Elise Stefanik. You've had Mike Turner, who chairs House Intel. You've had Chairmans Comer and Jim Jordan also write letters to the DOJ asking for Merrick Garland to reinvestigate Cohen. And there the other cases against Trump with the Fannie Willis case in Georgia. You've also seen members of Congress try to weigh in on that, mm-hmm. try to pressure these jurisdictions to provide documents and paint this all as a weaponization of the judicial system. So they're not only there physically, they're also doing all they can to support Trump.
Let's look at some of the footage of like who's there behind Trump. And, you know, Tom, you make this point so like acutely. It's so normal. And yet it is so freaking weird. Like that they are going to court where he is on trial for felonies. And the topics are not, they're very unsavory. We're talking about, you know, a porn star saying she had sex with him. We're talking about, you know, Michael Cohen accusing him of signing off on the checks. So among the people we see there are, as you guys said, Speaker Johnson. We're also seeing a range of people who might have other aspirations, like to say, I don't know, be the VP nominee, James?
I think, yeah, three of the guys right there can see themselves. Vivek Ramaswamy, the former rival. And a lot of people are, you know, they're trying to ingratiate themselves. This started actually with Susie Wiles, who is Trump's top strategist, asking Rick Scott, the Republican senator from Florida, to go to show support for Trump. He agreed. And then a lot of the others who have subsequently gone sort of volunteered organically. They weren't asked. And people, you always think about motives, and not only in court reporting, but in political reporting. And it is really striking how many people are trying to get back in Trump's good graces, who had sort of had a falling out of various kinds. For example, today, Bob Good is there. He's the chairman of the House Freedom Caucus, voted to depose McCarthy. Kevin McCarthy, a speaker. There's a primary coming up next month in Virginia, and Trump supported him 2 years ago, but is not supporting him this time because he endorsed and campaigned for Ron DeSantis. So this is Bob Good essentially taking a trip to Mar-a-Lago to try to tie himself to Trump.
Except instead of going to Mar-a-Lago, he's going to New York City. I mean, that's where it's almost normal, right? It's like they're going to pay homage to the man who's the presumptive Republican nominee. That's normal. What's weird about it is
that he's... You don't go to a courthouse when he's on trial for 34 felonies.
And you hold yourself out as a social conservative. He used to work at Liberty University. Right. You know, it is, you know,
fascinating.
Ralph Norman from South Carolina, mm-hmm. he endorsed Nikki Haley. He's one of the people who's there today, too.
Mostly men, but there are some women.
Some women, two women who we have not seen, Melania Trump and Ivanka Trump.
Mm-hmm. Or Tiffany Trump.
Mm-hmm. We have seen Laura Trump, the daughter-in-law, but we've seen Eric almost every day, the Laura's husband. But it is striking that it is, if Melania was sitting there showing support, perhaps that
it might go a long way. It might go a long way to the jury.
I totally agree with that. Yeah. And I don't know why they didn't. She must have really aggressively resisted that, mm-hmm. because that's a, rule one for defense attorneys is show the jury that this guy at least has family support, because they're trying to claim that he, you know, was protecting his family. And they said in their openings, he's a family man.
I wonder how many of the jurors recognize the Republicans who are going in to sit in Trump's section.
I was thinking that same thing. And I don't know if that would help your case by having members of Congress who have the lowest approval rating. People are very frustrated with Congress. So it's not as if a host of members of Congress, I feel, you know, would turn the tide with the jury. I don't think that they would. Also, a lot of people do not recognize their own member of Congress, let alone 30 of them from other states. So that's also an interesting component as well.
Trump wants this to seem political. He wants the whole trial to seem political, the prosecution to seem political. So having a bunch of politicians there does sort of help with that, with this idea that they're coming after me because I'm the leader of the Republican Party.
But that
Party
might be with the outside audience. I don't know if
he's definitely playing an outside game and an inside game. And I think it's totally true that he really likes having these people there to say things that he cannot.
There's also been reporting that this is to also boost his morale.
For sure.
Right. This is to help him not be blue.
And they dress like him.
You know,
Was the red tie part of the strategy?
Rhonda called to our attention an ad, because this has also become a fundraising mechanism and tool. So Rhonda, tell us about the red tie ad.
Yeah, there was an ad that went out this week where it shows a group of some of the members of Congress who came. They're in the hallway, one of the hallways of the court house.
One of the hallways of the courthouse.
Yeah, it's stunning to really think of that. And they have a very, it appears to be scripted. I don't think it's off the cuff, and ask for money, an appeal. And we've seen this before. We've seen this when Trump had, photos of him after the indictments last year, you know, the mugshot photos. These are tools that the Republican Party has used to help fundraise. And
so we're going to play the ad. So who are we going to see in this?
You're going to see Representative Byron Donalds, Representative Corey Mills, Laura Trump, Eric Trump. Vivek Ramaswamy, and you may even see an appearance by the defendant. So
keep your eyes peeled. Let's roll the tape.
We're here in court with President Trump standing with him, but we need you to stand with him too. Go to DonaldJTrump.com. Support President Trump in his efforts to win this election. These Democrats are nuts and they must be defeated.
Anything you can give would make a world of difference. We are here fighting the good fight. They cannot win. We need your help to make America great again.
This year, now or never for the country. Step up. Save this country. We're counting on you.
We know the lawfare that's going on, and only you can make the difference. Stand with President Trump the way we stand with him today. Look at what they're doing to him, and just remember his words. They're not coming after him. They're coming after you, and he's just in the way.
Let's make America great again, and he's the man to do it.
He's the man.
Why are you laughing, James?
I mean, it's funny. It's hilarious.
Why is it funny?
Trump stumbling into the shot and
so
giving
for
a
our
thumbs
audio,
up.
Okay, for our audio audience, for those listening on podcasts, and you can listen to us on podcasts or watch us on YouTube. Okay, so what's happening here is these guys and Laura Trump are like talking to the camera, and then Donald Trump just happens to walk by in the background in a in a hallway of a courthouse, walk by, and then they all pivot to him and they point to him as like he's the man. And then Trump gives like a big thumbs up, like he pops in the frame. Have I nailed it?
I mean, you have nailed it. I'm interested to see the next FEC filing, the Election Commission filing, to see if that ad or this whole experience in New York has added to Trump's coffers for him to use for his campaign.
James won't be laughing then.
The campaign's paying for the lawyers. I mean, Todd. Yeah.
It's one of those things where when I watched it, I thought if someone showed me this ad 20 years ago, 15 years ago, you know, and covering politics of what we knew then, would any of us be stunned? Yes, we would have been stunned. The presumptive nominee is, I don't know if they were on a break or at some point, is in a hallway in a courthouse, and you have members of Congress and the co-chair of the RNC. All
who happens to be his daughter-in-law.
Right. Those details, you wouldn't have believed it.
One of the things that happened this week that we just no longer even pay attention to because we are kind of numb to this is Henry Barber, who's the nephew of Haley Barber, the former chairman of the RNC and governor of Mississippi. He's a longtime member of the Republican National Committee, and he has, for the last several conventions, been part of the Rules Committee, which is really powerful in terms of shaping the way that the convention goes and the process for the platform and stuff like that. He introduced a resolution at the RNC spring meeting that said the RNC should not be paying Trump's legal bills. And the Trump people retaliated this week by kicking him off all these convention committees, even though his family has been so involved in the RNC for decades. And it is evidence, along with all these people going to New York, of just how much the GOP is in his grip. The takeover is very much complete.
I want to mention one thing. The Republicans there talked about lawfare, and that's a word that you hear a lot if you're running in like right-wing circles or listening to like right-wing podcasts and things like that. The idea of it, though, is that you're using the legal system as like warfare, right, as a way to attack an opponent. Did I say that right, Tom?
That's exactly right. And it's a sort of a new term in terms of being used as a, this is a weaponizing of the law. And this was not a concept that previously anybody had ever raised. If the law was invoked, it was supposed to be sort of a objective. This is, you know, a grand jury has looked at these facts and has decided to issue these charges. And the accusing the system of being political is a sort of a new thing. And sort of like people showing up to support a repeatedly indicted defendant. These are all new things. I might point out that shooting video in the courthouse, in the hallway of a courthouse is a new thing and possibly an illegal thing because photography in the courthouse is illegal. And we actually had a reporter booted for the trial because she was taking a picture in the overflow room. A reporter from New York Magazine can't go in now because of this. And, there are some authorized cameras in a strict pen from the news media who film his statements going in and out of the courtroom. But I don't know who was filming that commercial.
Yeah, they were not in the authorized pen.
I don't think so.
This commercial was not produced in the authorized media pen.
Right.
All right. Well, coming up, Justice Juan Merchan. Who is he and how crucial is he to this case? And we'll also talk about just how fast the rest of this case could go. The man who's been presiding over Trump's case and keeping everything moving is New York Supreme Court Justice Juan Merchan. Tom, you've been looking at Merchan's background and history, but first tell us what he's like in the courtroom.
He's really even-tempered. Even when he is angry, you wouldn't know it from his tone of voice. He's able to tell people to shut up, sit down. You know, he said to one of the defense lawyers one day, "Are you hard of hearing? Did you not hear me when I said blah, 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 blah?" Another time, he told one of Trump's lawyers who said, "I'm not trying to interrupt you, Judge." And the judge said, "Yes, you are. Sit down." But he does it in a very even manner. And he seems he doesn't seem rushed at all. There's never any impatience. I've never heard him say, "Let's move along, counsel," or, you know, "You asked that three times." He lets things unfold. When he asks about timing, it's only to, you know, let the jury know what's happening with the case. He's very detailed in his rulings and very well known, very well versed in the law. He doesn't waste time, but at the same time, he's not rushing. I've seen a lot of judges who are very impatient to get to the next thing, to get this case over with, to get this case to the jury. You never hear that from him. And anytime he asks them, "Who's your next witness?" or "What's coming next?" he mainly is doing it, "I'm just wondering," not because "I want you to finish this case by Tuesday because I've got a plane ticket to Aruba." It's none of that. He's very level. I've watched him in court in other matters outside of this. Same thing. Almost a friendly demeanor, making eye contact with the witness or the defendants. Every morning he says, "Good morning, Mr. Trump," looks right at him, waits for a response, doesn't usually get one. But that's what he does with all the defendants. And he's just very chill.
So, Tom, he really mixed it up with Trump's lawyers for a while there. And there was sort of a question in my mind of how much the jurors would perceive that, because a lot of that was happening sort of pre-trial.
Right.
Is there tension between them?
There seems to be less. It's gone down some since I think it was the first or second day of opening statements, or first or second day of testimony. He said to Todd Blanche, one of the lead defense attorneys, "You're really losing credibility here, Mr. Blanche. You're losing all credibility with the court." We didn't see Blanche for a little while after that. And Trump has two other lawyers with him. The other one is an older guy who's a little bit more dignified and respectful of the court. Even at one point offered to apologize to a witness, which, you know, that word's not even in the Trump vocabulary. And if somebody had said to Trump, "I'm going to apologize to this witness," he would have shot that down. So the tension was, I think, high at the beginning. And then as Bovey, Emil Bovey, who was handled the next couple of witnesses, was much more level and less confrontational, and also not going back on some of these arguments that had been raised numerous times about should the judge recuse, should this evidence be brought in, should this evidence not be brought in, things that the judge had ruled on before trial. Blanche would raise them again. This is what got the judge impatient. So there was a lot of this stuff pre-trial that sort of played into their personality dynamic, and now that has kind of faded. Mm-hmm. Everybody seems to be getting along.
Of course, outside the court, Trump is constantly going after the judge, and the gag order prevents him from talking about a lot of other people, but he can still talk about the judge. It's kind of a carve out there, which has happened in other cases. So judges' daughters off limits, court employees are off limits, juries off limits. Of course, witnesses are supposed to be off limits. Do you guys have questions for Tom since he's been watching the judge?
I mean, Trump seems like the most impossible defendant to control, but obviously there are situations where defendants are literally impossible to control.
Right.
We see videos sometimes.
So there was there was an interesting episode where, and none of us could hear this, even the people in the courtroom couldn't hear this, but while Stormy Daniels was on the witness stand, Trump was apparently cursing her. Mm. And so the judge called a recess. He said he's in the middle of the after a question, he said, "Is this a good time?" And they took a break, and he called the lawyers up to the bench and said, "Your client is cursing and he's shaking his head, and the jury can see this, and the jury might be intimidated by this. Tell him to stop it. And I called you up here because I don't want to embarrass him." And that's pretty thoughtful. Apart from the whole giganticness of an ex-president on trial, it is being considerate of a defendant's rights and not making the defendant look bad. And I can't tell you how many times I've sat in a courtroom where a judge has said, "Shut up," or "You stop doing that," and you know, and humiliated them in front of the jury and in front of the courtroom. And here the judge took steps not to do that. And I think that was just not because of this case and its hugeness as much as just being fair to the defendant and trying not to prejudice him in front of the jury by saying, "Hey, stop being a jerk over there." Instead, he called the lawyers up and said, "Tell him to stop being a jerk."
Yeah, it does seem like from the beginning of this case that he has had that kind of cool temperature to him and is trying to, you know, make that be the environment and not have a circus. I've just been interested, and this is probably more of a statement than a question, about how he has handled also doing all of these contempt of court hearings with the case itself.
Right.
And he doesn't seem like he's getting exasperated. And I know the last time we heard from him on that, he said he did tell Trump, you know, jail could be next.
Right.
But he's never gone that far. But it does seem he's very aware that he does not want this entire experience to get out of hand and become a circus and also be utilized by the former president to use for campaigning.
And Tom, how much of his background has prepared him for this? Like, where is he? We can throw his picture up there again. We're so used to seeing court sketches that
right.
when I saw his photo again, I was like, oh, he's not like a cartoon. He's like, there he is.
I actually delivered a letter to him last week asking him to sit for a photo for us. I have not gotten a response to that. But he is a native of Colombia, from Bogota. His family moved to Queens when he was six. He's the youngest of six. He grew up working and running groceries and working in a diner. He graduated undergrad from Baruch College and then got a law degree in 94 from Hofstra and immediately started in the prosecutor's office. So he's been a prosecutor in the Manhattan DA's office. Then he worked in the attorney general's office doing civil rights stuff, and then he became a judge. Not long after that, he took on the mental health docket, which is people who have mental illness and have been arrested. And instead of putting them in jail, they're going to therapy and treatment and medication and things. And he handles that. And then there's a veterans affairs docket for veterans who've been arrested, who can be diverted away from jail to, you know, improve their lives. And he handles that court just like the Trump court, very evenly, no rush. What do you have to say to me? Here's what I have to say. Here's what I'm going to do. One week I watched him and there was a guy who wasn't ready and he sent him back to jail. And 2 weeks later, the same guy comes out and he's done all the right things. And the judge says, "I'm letting you go today." And he walked right out of the courtroom. Wow.
A big question on everyone's minds. Will Donald Trump take the stand? Now, I want to just say here, if you have more questions for Tom than we've been able to get to him today, you can actually submit them to a live chat that you're going to be doing, Tom, on Friday.
Right.
So that's tomorrow when we're taping this, 11 a.m. I'm going to say New York time, just because it's all the focus is on New York. And you and some of our other colleagues who've been in the court are going to be answering readers and listeners' questions. So here's my question for you. Do you think there's any chance that Trump could testify?
No.
James?
No.
Rhonda?
I'm a no, but I will also point out that he did take the stand in the E. Jean Carroll case in January. He was very limited. You could tell that his lawyers did not want him to go off the rails. And there was a lot of danger in having him on the stand. He certainly has been complaining that he hasn't been able to talk. So if you give him an opportunity to talk, it may backfire. So for that reason, I would say no. But he has testified before in a case. We've seen it before, so
I started to laugh because, Rhonda, I feel like you were our sage who's always like, never say never, and then like the most surprising things happen, and you're like, yep, I told you that might happen. Any defense attorney would totally recommend that he not take the stand because he just opens himself up to the cross, which could be just absolutely.
And there's been great discussion about if he takes the stand, what can we ask him about? Mm-hmm. What can, and the judge has had to rule and has ruled on what can come in and what can't come in. And so what is going to come in is the verdict in E. Jean Carroll, the verdict in the civil case against the Trump Organization. His contempt of court stuff is not going to come in. It has not come in so far. The jury doesn't know, theoretically, that he's been out there bad mouthing Cohen and witnesses and the judge. The judge is trying to, again, play that fair, but at the same time allow the prosecution to say, look at this guy's background. You thought Michael Cohen had a background. Check out this guy.
James, why do you think Trump won't testify?
Because it opens up, you know, he can be asked about these depositions. He can make it opens up a lot. And he also, I mean, I guess the biggest reason would be that he could perjure himself. So you either will have a situation where the former president of the United States is taking the fifth or perjuring himself, and that could open himself up to other charges. And I mean, I think the Donald Trump's biggest focus this year is on winning the election because he can't control the New York or the Georgia verdicts. They seem to think that they have some chance on appeal in New York. But if he wins the presidency, he will be able to dismiss the charges against him in D.C. and the classified documents case in Florida. And I know from talking to people in Trump world that is his singular focus, is winning the election. And he will do whatever it takes to win the election. He'll pick whoever he thinks will give him the most help for VP. He will say whatever. He'll do whatever he wants to win. And the legal jeopardy is very, very top of mind in making him feel that way.
This case could wrap up in days, Tom.
It could. Today's Thursday. It looks like we may have closing arguments as soon as Tuesday of next week. So then will the jury, how long will they take? I mean, will it be a quick, they'd have Tuesday, no trial Wednesday, they would deliberate Thursday. Would they be able to deliberate on these charges in a day?
No court on Friday before Memorial Day, no court on Memorial Day. So if they don't have a verdict by then, it kicks over to the Tuesday after Memorial Day.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Thank you so much, Tom, James, Rhonda. Great conversation. We'll be back next week and we'll see if we have a verdict by that point. Possible?
I'm excited for Tom's live chat.
Yes. Okay. So again, I mean, we're talking to you in like real life live. So I feel like we get the better deal here. But yes. Tom and some of our other colleagues, Shana Jacobs, Devlin Barrett, Mark Berman, Rachel Weiner are going to be doing a chat online 11 o'clock Friday, 11 o'clock New York time, WashingtonPost.com. You can find it there. And also definitely check out the Trump Trials newsletter. It's our sister publication where we got our title of our show inspiration from. They're just cranking out newsletters as the news warrants and covering all the bases. We'll be back at least by next Thursday, if not sooner. We'll see what the news tells us. Thanks for listening to the Trump Trials Sidebar. We'll see you soon.
Harvey Firestone helped invent the American highway road system. So it's only fitting that Firestone Complete Auto Care would have our epic sales event in the heart of the road trip season. From June 6th to 9th, you can stop by your local Firestone for up to $100 off select services, so you can get going on your next adventure. Limited time offer, conditions apply. Go to FirestoneComplete.com for details.